Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour is one of the authors of Bayard Rustin, The Invisible Activist. And the co-authors write in the intro to the book that they wanted to reach young readers. The life of Bayard Rustin can inspire, they say, and educate young angelic troublemakers in the making. The man who was courageous enough to go to jail for his belief in nonviolence during World War II, who was smart enough to organize the 1963 March on Washington for jobs and freedom, humble enough to help young leaders like Martin Luther King become important figures in the nonviolent struggle for civil and human rights, can inspire you. And he's a person who's very often left out of the history books, even though he was an enormously important person to the civil rights movement, to the gay rights movement, and to the anti-military movement as well. So we are delighted to highlight his life this hour of the program. Jacqueline Hauptmann is our guest, and Jacqueline is one of the writers of this book. She is mostly a science writer and a children's novelist, but when she was approached, she says, with an opportunity to collaborate on this biography for young readers, she jumped on it. She has a PhD in medical microbiology and immunology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she left the lab in 1996. She has written science pieces for adults and children in World Book Science, all kinds of different magazines, and for various foundations, and decided to start writing fiction for young readers and enjoyed it and tried her hand at novels, and now she's doing nonfiction. We're going to be welcoming phone calls as we talk about the extraordinary life of Bayard Rustin. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Jacqueline, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
And thank you so much for writing the book. I'm amazed how many people, there seems to be a generational divide here, that people my age, and I'm older, and people who are younger, the younger people just are not very familiar with Bayard Rustin, and he's such a person worth knowing about, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, he was just an amazing guy. And, my experience is that the vast majority of people have never heard of him.
Why? Why is that?
He just wasn't really included in a lot of the history books. He wasn't in the front lines. You know, he was more of a behind-the-scenes kind of guy for a lot of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
One of the main reasons was that he was gay.
That's what I was thinking, that it was a time he could find a community in New York where he felt comfortable and certainly was comfortable in his family. But in a larger sense, it was not easy to be a gay man in those years.
Oh, no, it wasn't. It's probably one of the worst times to be a gay man.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we start with, if we want to talk about why we should remember him, I mean, people won't know this, that he was arrested for sitting in the whites-only section of a bus 13 years before Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat, and he was beat up for it.
Oh, yeah. That was in 1942, and that was a really pivotal time for him because he had been traveling around the U.S., teaching people about nonviolence in the manner of Mohandas Gandhi. And this was really, he knew a lot about it. He'd been training people in it. But this was really the first time that he actually used nonviolent direct action effectively. And it's a really, he wrote about it. And, you know, the incident in the book is taken a lot of it directly from his own writings and his own memories of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a really turning point in his life because he really saw the value of nonviolence.
Let's start with his early years because it does make you realize how important families can be, how important teachers can be. In his case, how important his grandmother was.
Oh, yeah. Julia Rustin was probably the most important person to affect him as he was growing up. She was his grandmother, but she and her husband, Jennifer, raised him as their son. And I may slip and call her his mother sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were that close. She was a Quaker. She was raised a Quaker because her mother was a maid in the household of a Quaker congressman. She went to a Quaker school. She went to nursing school. And this was in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Very large density of Quakers. Actually, my husband and I got our Quaker wedding license in Westchester.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. A lot of Quakers there. So the Quaker influence was very strong in his life. And the publisher of this book is Quaker Press, and one thing that they wanted to do is to really emphasize the importance of his Quaker upbringing and his Quaker beliefs on all of his actions.
And she realized, Julia, his grandmother, not only an important teacher, but very accepting of him, very accepting of the fact that he was gay, and also one of the people who saw brilliance in him early on.
Yeah, she was a huge supporter. There's an episode in here where she marches into the school and demands that the school stop trying to turn her left-handed grandson into a right-hander because he was who he was. And that's kind of how she accepted him for who he was, all aspects of his life.
It was interesting to me that he went to a high school, which must have been pretty unusual in those days, Westchester High School, which was integrated.
Yeah, it was. The reason I think that the high school was integrated is that so few African-Americans ended up finishing high school. They would just drop out after the first year or two because there was really no use. There were no good jobs out there. The education wouldn't really do anything for them. And when he attended this integrated high school, his grade school was segregated, but he didn't really... It didn't really bother him until he started going to an integrated high school because he developed really strong friendships with a lot of the white students. But outside of school, he really couldn't go to their homes. He couldn't go to the movies with them. He couldn't go to the same restaurants. And so that's when it really became clear to him that segregation was really not a good thing.
Mm-hmm. And it also became pretty clear to him that it wasn't a good thing when he graduated from high school and what choices were available to him compared with some of his white classmates.
Yeah, I mean, he graduated with some of the highest honors that there were. He was successful in athletics, in dramatics, in music, especially in music, in academics. He was just all around. He excelled at whatever he did, and he got the most what they call honor points of any students when he graduated. His best friend, John Cessna, who was white, was also very accomplished. He ended up going to Penn, University of Pennsylvania, but Byard got no offers. And so his mother walked up to a lot of businesses and tried to find him someplace. You know, they couldn't afford to send him to college. So finally, he got an offer to attend Wilberforce, which is a historically African-American institution. Because of his singing, he got a music scholarship to attend Wilberforce in Ohio, and that's when he went to college there.
And he was quite a singer.
Oh, he was beautiful. A lot of the time when I was writing, I would play recordings of his voice.
Oh.
It was really wonderful. Just a gorgeous tenor. His choir director in high school taught him a lot of classical music, which he liked to sort of surprise people who expected African Americans to only be singing spirituals. There was one assembly where he sang an opera aria in Italian. and so he just liked to do that, to just show people that their stereotypes were just totally wrong.
Yeah, I'm going to get rid of your stereotype instantaneously by doing that, right?
Yeah.
It's gone. But it's interesting, he went to Wilberforce and objected, you write, to the military training that was required of all male students.
Mm-hmm. Wilberforce was run by the AME church, and they were not, you know, typically a pacifist church, and so they had ROTC training, and he objected to that, and that's one of the possible reasons why he left Wilberforce before graduating.
And that came directly as a result of his Quaker upbringing, do you think?
Oh, definitely. His grandmother, you know, instilled in him this idea that every human being had an equal value, and that killing people and war were just wrong, and that was the basis for all of his social activism. And once he attended, he then went to Cheney State Teachers College, which is near his home in Westchester, and that was a Quaker institution, and that's when his Quaker values really kind of matured, and he really committed to being a Quaker.
You're right, and this is really quite something to say about somebody back in the 1930s. He accepted, you write, sexual orientation as a natural part of his personality and refused to hide it or to feel ashamed about it. His grandmother did not belittle or condemn his attraction to men. I'm thinking that must have been quite something back in the 30s.
Oh, yeah, it was. But Julia was, I think she was less concerned about his sexual orientation than about him choosing the right people to be around. Because she saw that, you know, if he chose the wrong people to associate with, then that could damage his reputation more than the actual, more than anything that he had done.
Mm-hmm. He found his way to New York, which eventually became really his home.
Yep.
And felt quite comfortable there.
Yeah, I mean, he lived in Harlem. He first lived with his Aunt Bessie. And there were musicians there who used to associate with each other. He used to fill in for people at the Apollo Theater when the main acts weren't available. And so he had this, there was this whole community of artists and social activists, and they were white, and they were black, and they were gay, and they were straight. And there was also a Quaker organization or community there as well. So I think he just felt like Harlem was a place that he could really fit in.
Mm-hmm. And at this time, his activism begins to get even larger on a larger stage. Tell us about his meeting and work with Philip Randolph.
So, well, A. Philip Randolph was the founder of the union, the Railroad Porters Union. I'm
mm-hmm.
not remembering the name.
Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters,
right,
you call
right.
them. Yeah.
And he was already, he was a very respected member of the civil rights movement. And he got involved with A. Philip Randolph when he was starting what was called the March on Washington movement. And that was early on, they were going to march on Washington and demand that the defense industries be desegregated. But Roosevelt then relented because he was afraid of all these African Americans coming down to Washington, and so he desegregated the defense industries. And so they had to sort of cancel that plan, but obviously they kept it on the back burner for quite a few years until it came to fruition in 1963 for other reasons. But A. Philip Randolph was really his mentor. He was a nonviolent. He was actually kind of a socialist. But he was, as I said, well-respected, and he was very supportive of Byard all throughout his life.
Hmm. The other thing that must have been a part of his resume that he had to hide in some ways, or maybe he didn't, was he was opposed to war. He didn't report for his physical for induction into serving in World War II and sentenced to federal prison.
Yes, he, as a Quaker, he received conscientious objector status. And so when he was called up, to report to for a physical and then to go to one of the civilian public service camps. But he decided that even that was supporting war, so he refused to show up for his physical. And he was arrested, and he reported himself to the prison. He didn't, you know, he didn't have them come get him, which was a very Gandhian thing to do. And he served about 2.5 years in federal prison.
Goodness, that's a long time.
Yeah, it was. But, of course, he was stirring up trouble in the prisons as well because they were segregated, and he tried his best to do what he could about changing that situation.
And then after World War II, continued with his anti-war organizational skills, organizing meetings, calling for young men to burn their military service registration cards.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, he was very much opposed to war. And this was, you know, he was traveling all over. He was doing a lot of work with youth, training them in nonviolence, training them in pacifism and social justice issues. This was both with the March on Washington movement and also with A.J. Mustey's organization called the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which was a sort of pacifist organization. And A.J. Mustey was another one of his kind of mentors.
There, you think about people that we know about now, like Rosa Parks, and you think about the Freedom Rides. We'll move into the part of Rustin's story of an interracial group of men riding buses throughout southern states in 1947. So a lot of what we know about, he was involved. It predates the history that most of us are familiar with. We're talking about Bayard Rustin this hour of the program. The Invisible Activist is the name of the book, and Jacqueline Hauptmann, who's one of the authors, is with us this hour. Some of you will remember him. He was a very close advisor to Martin Luther King, and essentially he organized the March on Washington in 1963, which was a huge march, and created and necessitated a brilliant person to be behind all the organizational skills that needed to take place to have that kind of success. He also, how many people even remember, he spoke right after Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech. But who remembers what Rustin had to say? Who remembers much of his life? Perhaps because he was a gay man that we don't, and because he didn't serve in World War II and protested war, that we have not remembered him in history. But he just did so many things. And as he said, we need a group of angelic troublemakers, and that's a wonderful description for who he was. We welcome phone calls, and here's how you can reach us if you would like. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. The book is written for young people, 10 and up, but it's a biography. It's very well done that anybody would benefit from. So we'll continue our conversation with Jacqueline in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For you to join the conversation, the number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We'll take a call for Jacqueline, and then we will introduce another of the authors of the book that we're talking about, Bayard Rustin, the Invisible Activist. Walter Nagel will join us as we continue, and I guess he will do that right now. He was Rustin's partner for a decade, and when Rustin died in 1987. Walter Nagel was instrumental in establishing the Bayard Rustin Fund, which is a private foundation that promotes Rustin's values and begins and works to heighten awareness of his accomplishments. So in addition to Jacqueline, we also welcome you, Walter, to the program. Hi.
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 Hi, Walter.
Hi, Jacqueline.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us. And thank you for writing this book. People need to know more about this man. He should just be front and center of the civil rights movement, and to have him neglected is really shameful, don't you think, Walter?
Well, I think, I don't know whether I would use the word shameful, but I think it's important that people learn about who he was, and especially young people. But, I also think, the thing we often forget is that, it was a movement, and there were many, many people. And so often we focus on Dr. King, who was a great man. And, Bayard is getting some attention now, but there were others, too, like, Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young and certainly A. Philip Randolph, many of the people that were involved in the leadership at the March on Washington. And very often they just get kind of pushed to the side because, I don't know, for some reason in this country we seem to, focus on one
yes.
kind of leader or one hero. And really, when you're talking about movements, you're talking about many, many people.
Mm-hmm. When did you meet him? How did you meet him?
I met him in 1977. It was quite, serendipitous, you could say. I was, at that point, I was thinking about moving out of New York City, and I was on my way to buy a San Francisco Chronicle to kind of scope out the job and apartment situation out there. And while I was waiting on a corner to cross the street to the store, Bayard came along, and suddenly lightning struck.
Well, that was fortuitous, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. I never made it to San Francisco.
I guess you didn't.
Not to live.
Well, did you say hello, or how did you get to?
Yeah, yeah. Said, you know, hello, I'm Johnny Cash. No, it was hello. You know, we just introduced ourselves and started talking, and the conversation went on for about 10 years.
For 10 years?
Yeah.
So what kind of activism was he involved in when you were together?
Well, he was still kind of a senior figure in, what they called the Civil Rights Leadership Forum at that time in this country. But he had also returned to things that he was doing when he first started out, international affairs work, promotion of human rights abroad. He got very involved with the International Rescue Committee and was working on refugee issues. Specifically at that time, there were a lot of Indochinese refugees coming out of Vietnam and Cambodia. And so the IRC was very involved with those groups. He also got involved with refugees from Haiti. Promoting democracy in various parts of the world, observing elections where democracy was just kind of starting to get a foothold.
Mm-hmm.
And with a group called Freedom House, he would very often be an election observer.
And tell me about, and Jacqueline, chime in here as well. Obviously, we know him for planning the enormously important March on Washington in 1963. He really did all the legwork and made that happen. If it weren't for his participation, it probably wouldn't have been as successful as it was. Do you think, Jacqueline?
Oh, no. And there are quite a few people who say that it could not have happened at all without Byard's participation. He was just an amazing organizer. 80,000 cheese sandwiches. that's a detail that I like to put
thanks to Wisconsin.
Yeah.
That is a lot of cheese sandwiches. Did he talk to you? Did he ever reflect, or was it always on to the next thing, Walter? Did he reflect on that day?
Oh, yeah, he did sometimes. Usually he was very much in the present. But, a couple of times during those 10 years, there was an anniversary of the march, I guess the 30th anniversary, the 20th anniversary in 1983, and, people would do television specials and things and come in and interview him. So, he would reflect on it publicly, but it wasn't something he talked a lot about it at home, but it was, it was a glorious day in the civil rights movement history, so it was kind of fun to talk about it and fun to relive it.
Mm-hmm. And what about, the book talks about in the 1980s his speaking to gay rights groups, that eliminating discrimination and prejudice, now the most important step for advancing human rights in the U.S. Tell us more what he did in that regard.
Well, he was invited. He was not somebody who was active in the early days of the movement, like Stonewall and shortly thereafter. But in all fairness, it was very much a movement that was led by very young people. And there were people who were still very much involved in protest. And, at that point in his life, Byard had really moved from, the title of one of his articles was called From Protest to Politics. And so he would be out there protesting when it was absolutely necessary. But he also believed in organizing politically and using the ballot box and voting. So by the time the movement started advancing in the early 80s, he was, kind of a senior figure that people came and spoke to. There was a move to pass what was called a gay rights law here in New York City, and some of the people who were behind that initiative came to Byard's office and sat down with him and talked about coming and testifying before the city council about that. And I think that was really the moment when he kind of got involved more publicly in that struggle.
It sounds, though, from the tenor of the book and from what you say about him, that he always felt pretty comfortable being a gay man. It could not have been easy for him because the world was the way it was. It's getting a little better now, but during the time when he was politically active, to be a gay man, and I believe he was jailed in California, wasn't he?
Yeah.
At one point, tell us about that incident and how he seemed to be pretty comfortable with who he was and open about who he was.
Well, he was. He was comfortable. But at the same time, his being gay was constantly being used as a kind of a battering ram to kind of push him to the back and push him onto the sidelines. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, after a while, no matter how confident or how strong you are, when you constantly have a society that's telling you you're bad, you're wrong, you're this, you know, it must take some psychological toll. But Byard was very, very strong. He had a strong sense of who he was and a strong sense of self-confidence. So it didn't really, it certainly didn't push him into the closet. What was another part?
He was arrested for lewd behavior in California?
Yeah, he was arrested in, I guess, 1953 in Pasadena, California. It was apparently very late at night in an encounter on a back street in a car. It was the kind of thing in the 50s that, you know, straight people were doing all the time. I mean, back in the 50s, you weren't supposed to be having sex outside of marriage. So people were doing that in cars and motels and things like that. So, but, you know, when straight folks did it, they got a slap on the wrist and were told to go home to their parents. When gay people did it, they ended up in the slammer.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what's remarkable to read about in the book is all of the things that he did, and we hear about movements that took place that used exactly the same kind of tactics, the bus situation. Also, this group of really freedom riders that was some years before the ones that we remember that he was a part of, where an interracial group of men traveled by bus down south. Jacqueline, tell us about that.
Well, that was called the Journey of Reconciliation. And so there was, about 15 men, black and white, and they would ride, the white people would ride in the black section of the bus and black people would ride in the white section of the bus. And the whole idea was to sort of educate people about a recent Supreme Court decision, Morgan versus Virginia, which made segregation in interstate buses unconstitutional. They did not go into the Deep South as the Freedom Riders did. They were warned, actually, Thurman Marshall warned them against that because he had had some really bad experiences as a lawyer down in the Deep South. So they went to states like North Carolina. And in North Carolina, there was a violent incident in North Carolina, and four of them were arrested. They appealed the case, but they lost the appeal, and Byard ended up serving 22 days on a chain gang in North Carolina. And he wrote about that in two large publications, and as a result of that, it said that that's the reason why North Carolina ended the chain gang system. Because it was such a horrible thing. You know, he wrote so vividly about his experiences.
Right. How did he meet Dr. Martin Luther King?
King was working with the Montgomery bus boycott, and word was that things were getting kind of violent down there. So he met with people in the with A. Phil Randolph and some others, and they decided that they would send Byard down to Montgomery to kind of help train people in nonviolence. And so he arrived in February of 1956. King was about 26 years old at the time. And King had gone, he'd learned about Gandhi and, you know, who he was and what he did, but he really didn't have an understanding of the actual tactics and philosophy of nonviolence. He had guns in his house. He had armed guards around the house. And Byard told him, you know, if you want to have a nonviolent movement here, you've got to get rid of your guns. And so he convinced him, and he taught him a lot about nonviolence and really kind of molded him into what we know as the nonviolent Martin Luther King.
Oh, that's interesting. And he shocked people by some of his acts of not resisting arrest, right? People would look at him and say, "You're crazy, man."
When in Montgomery?
I believe it was when he was on the bus, right? When he was beat up on the bus.
Right, right, yeah. And that's, you know, one of the things about nonviolence is it sort of, when people witness nonviolent direct action, they sort of get put off balance because it's not what they're expecting. And so it's kind of a way to sort of change people's minds about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, you know, that was a huge part of what he did was teach so many people this truth about nonviolence. Mm-hmm. And that's I think it's one reason why the civil rights movement was so successful.
Why don't you weigh on this discussion of nonviolence, Walter?
Mm-hmm. Well, as far as Montgomery was concerned, what Jacqueline said is very accurate. There was also a writer named Lillian Smith who had wrote a book called Strange Fruit. She was a white Southerner, mm-hmm. and she was following the movement, and she had known of Bard, I believe, through the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and she sensed that he was kind of the right guy at the right time to come down there and advise him. So she also weighed in both in the South and also up here in the North. Bard's nonviolence was really, I think, as Jacqueline probably said earlier, it was really rooted in his Quaker faith, in a deep faith in Christianity, as the Sermon on the Mount. But as time went by, it also it became broader in the sense that it became more political. I think Bard recognized, although the Montgomery movement and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was really, in fact, based in Christianity and nonviolence, he also realized, well, if you were going to reach out and start appealing to a broader section of the society to build a coalition that you were going to need to pass legislation and to support legislation, you'd kind of, you need to move a little bit beyond strictly the Christian sense. And so his nonviolence also sort of developed, a political edge to it.
And I'm interested in just jumping ahead a little bit. I'm going to go back to the March on Washington for just a moment. We all remember, of course, and that's primarily what we remember of Dr. Martin Luther King is the I Have a Dream speech. Byron Rustin spoke after King, and I don't remember that. I don't remember even hearing any or seeing any video or statements about what he said after that march that he had organized. And he wasn't even on the program, Jacqueline. What did he say?
No. He read a list of the demands that had been determined, while they were organizing this. And actually, there's an image of those demands, the original document, in the book. They were, we demand an end to segregation in schools, for example, economic opportunities, things like that. And he got, a great response from the audience, but there is video of him doing that. It was pretty much, King's speech was basically the focus
right.
of all the attention.
Right. And what were his reflections on Martin Luther King, Walter?
Well, I think a lot of people kind of saw Bard, and I think Bard himself saw himself as kind of an older brother or a mentor, if you will, to Dr. King. He thought very highly of him. He admired his intelligence. I think he felt that he needed some schooling and actually kind of the nuts and bolts of bringing about nonviolent protests and putting it on the ground in the South. And that's really what Bard was able to bring to it. But I know he deeply admired Dr. King's intelligence and his, he could see him growing into or stepping into the role of a national leader, and really, as I guess Mr. Randolph described him when he introduced them at the march, as the moral leader of the nation.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to our president or somebody else in that position, Dr. King at that moment was really the moral leader of the nation, and I think Bard recognized that and certainly admired it.
And he did a lot to actually promote that as well.
How so?
Just by the way, there was a march before that, the peace pilgrimage, was it?
Prayer pilgrimage in 1937.
Okay, yeah. And he put a King last as the speaker, and it was his idea to put King last as the speaker in the March on Washington. He knew that was sort of going to be the focus, the pinnacle of the event. And so he sort of placed King there so that the rest of the world would understand what was going on.
Isn't it interesting to think of somebody mentoring Martin Luther King, but when you remind us how young he was and how he had armed guards at his house, et cetera, that you have this other person who we don't remember very well, who really was a mentor to Dr. Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm. He was.
Yeah,
Yeah, I don't think Martin Luther King would have been as much of a figure today in our minds and hearts were it not for Byard.
Yeah, I mean he was all set to go into Montgomery and be a very nice, upper middle class preacher, and kind of live a quiet family life. And partly because he was new in the community, that was part of the reason that he was kind of tapped to take on the leadership of the Montgomery Improvement Association, because he was sort of an unknown quantity. So the other religious leaders who had a history there kind of looked to him and sort of pressured him to taking on that position. And, he did it reluctantly. But I think with the help of them, as well as, the help of Byard and others, he kind of, rose and grew into that leadership position.
I just saw the Selma film over the weekend, which has its own set of problems, but there are parts of it that stay with you. And I'm wondering if Byard talked about this at all, Walter, this fog of death that Coretta talks about that she had to live with, which was too much, and that MLK admits to a fog of death entering his consciousness sometimes as well. What about Byard? Did he live with that as well?
Not so much. I mean, there were occasional threats that came through, but he didn't, partly because he didn't have that kind of high public profile that Dr. King had. He wasn't as much of a target.
We certainly welcome phone calls. It may be the kind of conversation you're just enjoying listening to because you don't know very much about him, but I'm sure there are many people who know a great deal about Byard Rustin. The Invisible Activist is the name of the book, and it is written for, it's written for everybody, but a particular emphasis and a hope that young people who won't be very familiar with his story will, and I think it's true that there aren't many people who are familiar with his story, will read the book and a new generation will learn about this. I guess you could call him an unsung hero who did so much in his life on so many fronts, anti-militarism, nonviolent movement, attacking racism, being a mentor to Dr. Martin Luther King, and being a very openly gay man, which may be one of the reasons that we don't know very much about him, because for that reason he was not front and center, organize the march on Washington. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. We now have two guests with us. Jacqueline Houtman is one of the authors of the book. She has been a science writer and a children's novelist for a long time, and she has a PhD in medical microbiology and immunology from UW-Madison. Walter Nagel was Byard Rustin's partner for a decade, and when he died in 1987, Walter established the Byard Rustin Fund, which is a private foundation promoting his values and works to heighten awareness of his accomplishments. To your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls, starting with Richard in Madison. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I have a question. I hope it's on topic. The question is this. How can angelic troublemakers, who are clearly visible, affect change today when super PACs of anonymous donors, of corporations, are controlling the electoral process?
Jacqueline.
I think we're seeing the beginnings of resurgence in the civil rights movement and in the kind of activism that Byard was all about, peaceful protest, nonviolent direct action. There are, the problem of money in politics and PACs and all that is a pretty big problem, and it's one of many problems. But I think Byard's philosophy is really something that we need to adopt to solve a lot of the problems that we're having here right now.
Where do you see remnants of his movement today, Walter?
Well, certainly in some of the protests that have taken place recently regarding police shootings.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't approve of all of the tactics that have taken place, but certainly some of them, he would have been right there with them. I think, the whole notion and I think this is what Byard would point out, the whole notion of a police force is really to serve the public and protect the public. They are our servants. We pay their salaries with our tax dollars. And so, they really need to be held accountable. It doesn't mean that everything that they do is wrong. It's not, and it doesn't mean that every person that's out there in the street is an angelic person. Some of them are troublemakers, and they're not so angelic. But I think you don't want to get into a position where you're sort of categorizing people as us versus them. I think one of the things he would recommend is that police should be members of the community that they are patrolling. They should be living in the community so that they get to know the community and the community gets to know them as people, as individuals, not as just a force or, a blue uniform or something like that. They should be their neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really how you kind of build community from the ground up. And that's what he was always about. It was not, he wanted to build. He didn't want to kind of tear down.
Douglas in Madison. Hi.
Oh, hello.
Hello. Go ahead, Douglas.
So it's a very, very interesting. Thanks for having me. First of all, it's a very interesting topic because when you talk about activism, things are still happening right now. So, for example, I lived in Uganda for about 3 years, and while I was there, the only open gay activist of the name David Kato in 2011, he was murdered because of just being openly gay. And so there are things in terms of being an activist that, things that happened so many years ago, and yet they're still happening. So considering that both of you have done a lot of the research in terms of, how does the activism back in the 30s and 40s have, influenced how we live right now, how would another country right now, in your opinion, would be able to benefit? Like, what would it take for them to get to the point that we are right now when you see that still to this day, only a gay activist gets murdered in different countries?
Jacqueline, I'd like to hear both of you respond. Jacqueline?
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a big problem. I'm at a loss at the moment. Can Walter pick up?
Oh, well, you have to. It's really about organizing and building, trying to build a community of like-minded people who will support you. Now, the particular instance that the gentleman cited on the telephone, it might have been impossible. There might not have been anything that could have been done. But I can tell you that he was not the only gay person in Uganda. There were others, or there are others, probably maybe many too afraid to speak publicly about it, even to their families. But somehow, some individual, and maybe by that man giving his life, has to be a force which will transform other people into at least thinking about this and starting to talk about these issues. Just because you're an activist, especially because you're an activist, there's no guarantee that you're not going to be hurt or harmed. As Jacqueline has talked about, Byard and his small group of activists from the FOR were out there in the 30s and 40s, and, they were risking their lives at a time when it was probably more dangerous doing what they did than it was in the 60s, because they were the only ones that were doing it. There were not a lot of people doing it. And so, it has to start small, and sometimes it starts with one person. Another example is the life of that Tunisian man who set himself on fire and, sacrificed his life because he was being oppressed, something to do with getting a license to sell and that kind of thing. And that little spark kind of set off what we know as the Arab Spring, which, of course, is certainly not gone perfectly well and very well in many cases. But the point is that sometimes it just takes the courage or the activism of one person to kind of start a movement. And I think probably that's, I know that there are other gay activists in Africa. I'm in touch with some of them. And I know that there are some who have come over here seeking asylum based on their sexual orientation. So there is work being done. But as I said, you know, there's no guarantee that it's going to be an easy journey.
Mm-hmm. Walter, tell me a little bit more about the Bayard Rustin Fund, your foundation.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you said, we were really set up to promote Bayard's values. And initially, we were really working to kind of get him into the history books and to make people aware of who he was. So we were contributing to people who were working on books, biographies about him. We started a fellowship program where we were bringing young people in and placing them in organizations for a year, the kinds of work that he did in the labor movement, refugee affairs, civil rights work, human rights work, and peace work. And we ran that program for about 6 or 7 years. Since then, really, it's largely been doing shows like this. I've done a lot of work with the filmmakers. There's a very good documentary called Brother Outsider, The Life of Bayard Rustin, which was actually shown in Madison not too long ago. I was out there for a showing of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been working with the filmmakers, traveling with them, talking about Bayard and talking about his life in the film. So a lot of what I'm doing now is really just kind of continuing to heighten awareness about him,
mm-hmm.
which is another reason that we hope that people will avail themselves of this new book.
I hope so, too. Melody and Mercer would like to avail herself of the book, I think. Hi, Melody.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm on my way into work, and I just heard this program, and I'm very excited that the reading level is at 10. I'm going to buy it for my daughter, as well as her niece and nephew. And so could you just repeat the name of the book again?
Jacqueline.
Oh, it's called Bayard Rustin, The Invisible Activist. It's published by Quaker Press. It's available at quakerbooks.org and some other online sellers. And I want to emphasize that Walter and I are not the only authors of this book. Michael G. Long, who is an academic in Pennsylvania, also worked on this book. Actually, I came on after Walter and Michael. I was the one who was brought on to sort of make the book a little more accessible and engaging for a younger audience.
Hmm.
And Michael was, 2 years ago, Michael published a collection of Bayard's letters called I Must Resist, Bayard Rustin's Life and Letters.
Thank you, Melody, very much for your call. Let's get to, we're running out of time here, but there was a movement, and this is an interesting story toward the end of the book, of residents in his hometown in Pennsylvania creating this plan to honor him for his contribution. A new high school was to be named with his name, at the Bayard Rustin High School, I believe it was, but it was not completely smooth going, was it, Jacqueline?
No. Well, they had planned to go ahead with it, and then they got a petition from about 550 people who objected to the school being named after a former communist and a lawbreaker and a war resister and a gay man. So they actually had to have a public hearing where people aired their grievances. Most people actually supported the school. And finally, I think it was a 6-3 vote, they voted to name it after Bayard. And it's kind of unusual because it's the district that it's in is a very conservative district. And so to have this named after this African-American, Quaker, gay, social activist was kind of a great thing. And I believe Walter has been to visit at that school.
Have you,
right?
Walter?
Yes, actually, I have been. I was there last, I guess, March or April. You know, Westchester is kind of a sleepy town, a suburban town out of Philadelphia, and there was a lot of racial tension there, and it's, you know, there still are vestiges and pockets of racism out there, but I do think it's changing. There's a Democratic mayor now who actually was with me at the White House last year when I accepted a posthumous Medal of Freedom on Bayard's behalf, and the mayor of Westchester was there with me. And I know that would not have happened under an earlier administration from the town. So I think, you know, things are turning around. And a lot of it, I think, of course, it's the young people. The young people do not have the issues and the hang-ups that some of us older folks have.
Yeah. Thank you both so much for being with us. The book is Bayard Rustin, The Invisible Activist, and two of the authors, Jacqueline Hauptmann and Walter Nagel, are guests this hour of the program. Thanks to both of them. It's for young readers. It's a book that will be of interest to all who are interested in angelic troublemakers. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour. Scotty Myers on air production. We'll be with you again on Monday following the Dr. Martin Luther King celebration in Madison. We'll have a panel of people to look at the issues that were of concern to MLK.